Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to the desperate, the disappointed, the despairing. Dudes, dudettes, don't kill yourselves. There's something to live for. Am I right? Kalo, Mark Riley, am I right?
You're right. There's something to live for.
Now, you know, it's like, you know, this is a big day in the news. The burning pile of poop stopped burning in Nebraska.
Yes.
Big news. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to start off on the wrong track, but it took nearly 4 months, but to the relief of neighbors miles around, a burning manure pile has been extinguished. So if you were planning a trip up to Milford, Nebraska to see the great burning poop pile, cancel your plans because that's over. Dude, how could that, can you, you know, I don't want to digress on that because we got big things to talk about. The unions are bouncing back. They're taking some action against Bush's Social Security plan. We're going to talk a little bit about No Child Left Behind getting some flack by all legislators of all kinds, all across the spectrum.
50-50 Democrats and Republicans.
That's right. We're going to talk a little bit about steroids later in the show. We've got an amazing couple of authors who wrote a book about suicide bombers, spending time with suicide bombers, the language of suicide bombers, the weird cryptic way they communicate with it, the cult of suicide bombers. That's later in the second hour of the show. So we've got a big day planned. We're going to try and discuss the difference between, you know, left and right and just how stupid people are when asked what the difference is. You know what's amazing is that on this program, on this network, you know, for whatever you think of me or whatever show you happen to like on this network or all the shows, is that, you know, there is a difference between, you know, what audience are you trying to get, really? You know, for some people, listening to certain shows feels like thinking to them. For some people, their anger is represented. The person on the show is their anger puppet, you know. And there's a sort of question of like, hey, you have to be moderate. You have to move to the center. You have to not talk about that. You don't want to be what they think we are. You know, we have to get, we have to pull the moderates over. We got to get some of those Republicans who may not see the light. We have to convert people. The truth of the matter is, there's what, about 70 million people in this country that don't vote? And that means there's about 40 million of them that don't care, and probably 50 million of them that are just idiots when it comes to any of this stuff. And I used to be one of those people, Riley, and those are the people that we need to connect with.
Well, let me tell you something, Mark. If you look at recent presidential election vote totals, you'll see that in the year 2000, about 105 million people voted. And last year, it went up to 122 million, an increase of 17 million. And in looking at the figures, this is the highest percentage, the highest number increase that I've ever seen.
And also, you know, if you are to believe the numbers, or even if you're not, what we've been told, or what has been accepted by, you know, the powers that be, is that there was a difference of about 3 million plus. Okay.
Yeah.
That's close. But there's still a bunch of people out there, I'm thinking about 70 million, am I right? That don't vote. Okay. These are people that walk through life that basically say, yeah, I don't care really. You know, yeah, I kind of like Bush, or, you know, Kerry was all right. They're not part of the process because they're too busy listening to their iPod or doing whatever they're doing, or, you know, going out and buying shoes, or, you know, worrying about what's in their immediate world.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, because for a lot of people, and this is the real sad part about where the electoral process is in the beginning of the 21st century, people are so disconnected in many cases from politics and the actual impact it has on their real lives that they think, well, it doesn't matter whether I come out and vote. Another thing, Mark, and we can't let this pass, a lot of people who are convicted felons in this country can't vote even if they want to.
Right.
You know, are folks that are in that predicament, unfortunately.
I just, like, I have an issue with the fact that, you know, in terms of, you know, how we present, you know, our show and, you know, mixing comedy with a, you know, multitude of subjects that aren't just sort of, you know, talking points for the left or just reacting to the right, you know, is a way to, you know, to bring people in because, you know, progressives, liberals, and people that don't know they're progressive or liberal who might be sensitive to some of the stuff we talk about. about, you know, those are the people that, that want to come in through the friendliness, through the entertainment, through the humor, through the way we present information. Those are the important people, the uneducated. And I got to be honest with you. I mean, unenlightened, perhaps, not necessarily uneducated. You know, for years of my life, I was a broad stroke kind of guy. You know, I would, you know, get involved with politics on just a purely reactionary level without knowing anything because I'm a pretty selfish person, as people will see in the HBO documentary about Air America. And, you know, you didn't come. You know,
I don't know.
I don't know why you didn't go, but, you know, you look pretty good, buddy.
Who?
You do.
I didn't figure I was in it.
You know what you're doing? You are sitting there. Here's what you're doing, Riley. At the beginning of this game, it's going to be on HBO. It's, what's it called? I don't even know what it's called. The Air America Left of the Dial. It's called Left of the Dial. It's a documentary about the beginning of Air America, the almost demise of Air America, and then the sort of, you know, tremendous rising of the phoenix, my friend.
The rise, fall, yeah. And rise.
So, you know, I was worried, you know what I mean? Because, believe me, I've been doing television a long time. I know what it's like to feel bad about looking, you know, about seeing myself on TV. There's a couple of sets that I watched. I'm like, no, not that haircut. Oh, my God. Not one laugh. Not one laugh. But you never know, because I did a show once in Aspen, you know, a taping of some stand-up show. I tanked. Not laugh one. It wasn't just a bomb. There was a suction to it that you could feel while you were watching the TV, you know. And then, you know, I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, and I hated myself for months. And then one guy comes up to me and he goes, you know, I love what you do, man. You're really funny. And I'm like, well, of course. I'm like, what'd you see? That thing you did in Aspen. I'm like, oh, my God. Really? You never know. But anyways, enough about me, because this isn't about me. What it's about is the documentary is interesting, but I was concerned that I would look like a selfish idiot. And on some level, I don't look like an idiot, but I certainly, you know, I didn't know what I was doing when we got here. So the way you look a lot of times is that, you know, I'm sitting there trying to learn how to be on radio, how to take whatever skills that I have, you know, accumulated over years of stand-up and put them into this and also put my mind into it. And there are a couple of moments where I think the look that you had, Riley, was like, how'd I get into this? who is this guy? What am I doing? There's a scene where me, you, and Larson sit in an empty room, and he's like, okay, we're just going to try and do a show, improvise a conversation. And you're sitting there, and we got a story about, you know, eight-year-olds playing in a sandbox with a gun or something, all right?
Wow.
I didn't even remember what the hell it was. And you were like, this is no problem. And you start the conversation, and I just go, this is ridiculous. I can't, what are we doing here? This is stupid, you know? But then the evolution of it was interesting. You know, they had they showed Randy, her whole trip. You know, a lot of people have never even seen Randy Rhoads, whose show we're going to be guest hosting tomorrow night again.
Yeah.
We will be presenting our show from last week that we did on Randy in the morning for our morning listeners tomorrow. But the idea is, as some of you know, on Air America, who are true Air America listeners, what we're doing is we're trying to expose ourselves to you know, some of Randy's people that don't necessarily listen to us in the morning, and show them what we do. And I hope that you'll not be too hard on us for taking the morning off in terms of you know, preparing for Randy's show. But we're only going to do it in as long as she's away. And I think this might be the last time. We might do one more. But nonetheless, they show Randy sort of ascent. And her sort of feelings of insecurity, because as many of us felt that, you know, well, it's really all about me right now. Yeah, I'm out franking, and it's really Franken America Air. Anyways. But, you know, so she was dealing with her own crisis, and Franken wasn't in it a whole lot. It was really about, there was a lot about Randy, there was a lot about the executive structure of the place, and you know, it got a little weighty in the middle. But I was scared because Sheila Nevins, who produces all the documentaries at HBO, including, like, Hookers at the Point, apparently was, you know, walking around saying, you know, we need more Marin. And I'm like, that can't be good. This is a woman that says, is that crack whore pregnant? Get her in the picture. Get her in the car. Is she working? This would be terrific. Is there more of the pregnant crack whore. So, you know, that made me nervous because, yeah, I wasn't sure her heart was in the right place in terms of wanting
exactly
more marriage.
Exactly why she wanted more of you. Oh, wow.
But I met her. She's a very nice nice woman. And it turns out that I thought that the people treated us pretty well, Riley.
They
treated
were cool.
Our show well.
They were really
They
cool.
treated the network well. You know, there was a... It was interesting because I felt that, like, I didn't, even though I knew how it was going to end, I was found it kind of moving the way it built, and there was Larson looked good. There was more of Larson. What did he say? He said that Yeah, the camera adds 45 pounds. And by the way, Kayla, what are you reading there?
Uh-oh.
I'm sorry. What are you taking a look at? Is that a comic book?
I mean,
you taking a little time off from the board?
Larson actually gave me his Weight Watchers.
I don't understand. We had a conversation yesterday. You felt pretty good about yourself. So what, is that just for entertainment value? Or?
Hey.
What?
I'm open to everything.
Whoa, what happened to, rub my belly, baby? I'm happy.
She still does that.
Oh, yeah, but what happened? I'm comfortable with myself. You don't need that.
I'm still comfortable. Oh, hey, you know what? We can talk about this over a beer.
I don't drink beer.
Oh.
No,
oh,
I don't. Yeah.
You're an alcoholic.
Yeah, okay.
Sad.
All right, but wait. No, I don't understand how that plays in. You know what? I think you should put that book away, all right, because you apparently are a hypocrite, and I'm going to get you an ice cream. It's 16 past the hour. I'm going to get you a tub of ice cream and some cup of noodles, you liar. I'm comfortable with my body. Now, Larson's converting you to the core plan.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no, we're going to have members of the Weight Watchers called dangling their sort of 10-pound keychains around. That's okay. So at least I have a multitude of problems that I deal with, but someone was in denial yesterday, and now you're born again fat. Well, good morning, Kalo. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition, the highest rated, most respected news show in America. On Air America Radio.
Yeah, what's going on, people? 21 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition. It's a program on Air America Radio where we give you some funny and some facts, some fury. So listen to Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. You know what I'm saying? Look, my friends, we've got a lot of stuff to cover today in a lot of different ways. Right now, I'd like to discuss, later on in the hour, we're going to talk about, the difference between left and right, and what we really know to be left and right, and whether or not people on the left actually know what left is, and whether people who don't know either are stupid or uninformed or what. Because we've had some discussion and we've had some articles come through our in front of our faces about, how much, what is it grounded in? You got a lot of people running around with George Lakoff's book trying to sort of, build new linguistic frames for them and their friends. But, what are we really founded in? So we're going to get into that in the next hour. Right now, Mark Riley and I would like to, you have found this piece. This is important stuff, that there's been a meeting of legislators that have deemed George Bush's education plan, No Child Left Behind, unconstitutional. And this is significant because Republicans are turning on the neocon death cult's blow monkey puppet.
They are, Mark. This is a study that took almost a year. It was done by the National Conference of State Legislatures. And believe it or not, the organization represents all 50 state legislatures, and a membership that includes, I get this, 3,657 Republicans and 3,656 Democrats.
Holy mackerel. So this is
right down the middle.
It's a report put out by this group of legislators.
Yes. And what they're saying is what a lot of activist parents across the country, a lot of school administrators, and a lot of politicians have been saying for a while, that No Child Left Behind imposes an unconscionable burden on the states without backing it up with enough funding, and that it's very difficult to figure out in many instances what constitutes compliance with No Child Left Behind.
So you're saying that it puts a burden on the states because the states have to impose certain restrictions, or there have to class sizes, tests. There's certain things that have to remain consistent for the plan, and these things take money.
Yeah, and see, what happens is schools get punished when their students fail to improve on standardized tests. Now, that means that, for example, if you're talking about a good school in the suburbs, and maybe they have a deficiency in a small deficiency in one area, if they don't improve that deficiency by a measurable enough standard, they could be on a failing schools list, even though everything else about the school works extremely well. That's one of the small problems.
And if the school is failing, this is some sort of applied Darwinistic approach to education, right? So if the school fails as an institution, as an organism of itself, They shut it down. They probably, that means that they're going to overburden other schools, except for people that can afford to go to private schools, or students that were good enough to move into better schools. So in a sense, the end game of this plan is going to overburden schools.
Well, yeah, and there's a Darwinism when it comes to this that has really irritated urban school districts all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is, under No Child Left Behind, parents have the right to take their kids out of schools that are designated as failures.
Okay.
Now, in theory, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you have a large urban district where there are large numbers of schools that are designated as failures, you immediately realize that there's not enough room in the good schools for all the kids that might want to get out of the bad ones.
Okay.
So
right,
then what
right.
happens? You get this kind of educational bureaucratic gridlock that doesn't benefit the kids at all.
And it
frustrates the parents because they can't move their kids out of these
schools. I imagine this has to add to some sort of economic class tensions. There must be some sort of, I just always assume that people with money can afford to put their kids wherever they want. So you have that element, and then you get that kids that aren't able to maybe economically accommodate their kids' desire to go to another school.
Well, see, that's where things get interesting, because many of the conservatives and the Republicans in this administration have, for example, pointed to vouchers,
mm-hmm.
pointed to other educational alternatives. You know,
right.
the whole idea that, well, if we had competition in education like we had in the private sector, more kids would benefit. Now, they don't really have any numbers to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
After some municipalities have begun the voucher programs and that sort of thing. But the important thing to realize here, Mark, is this.
Yeah.
The federal government contributes about 8% of the money needed to educate children. So what ends up happening with No Child Left Behind is it becomes an unfunded mandate. The states have to make up the difference. If they have to spend more money, it's not coming from Bush. It's coming from the property taxes that usually people tend to take out on those very local and state legislators.
So this is interesting. So the end game is if the federal government isn't willing to fund this, or there are some conservatives that want to make education just a state issue altogether and close down the National Department of Education, if that happens, what you're going to have is literally you could create almost completely stupid states if they're not careful.
Well, if they're not careful, and there are some states that just won't spend a great deal of money on education.
It's arguably there already are completely stupid states.
Well, you could say that. But what it means is that George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind, like many of his other initiatives, are now being attacked from people within his own party. That's something that we ought to be able to try and take some advantage of, don't you think?
The Republicans are turning on themselves, folks.
Yep.
It's a beautiful thing. We'll be back, right?
We'll be right back we're going to talk a little more about this and about Social Security as well when we return here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's the Air America Network. It's Morning Sedition program. Yes, right. Wow. Caleb, man, I don't mean to be hardening that. That was pretty.
Yes, you do, man. Pretty, you know you do.
Kind of a hurtful thing you said to me about the alcohol thing, and I understand. That was your only recourse. And I just want to say to you that I think it's good that you're going to lose some of that ugly fat.
Oh,
that you have hanging over your
all
belt.
All my fat is beautiful, right?
Then why do you have to do the core plan? I don't understand. You know what's funny? Pashman came in here and said, when did this become The View? Pashman, son of Louis, Linda Pashman, with one of the funny things he said that I just shared with you people. Let's get on. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Chris. I think it's important that you lose that weight just for your health, for God's sake.
Because... Oh, no. You know what you're doing to the poor man.
No, I'm not. Yeah, he can defend himself. I feel like I'm going to get hurt right now.
And no, it's all right. I'll eat a pint of ice cream and, and cry. It's all right.
Don't make fun of my hobbies. I know what you're doing.
Maybe I'll pet my 10 cats. I
have. Oh, my God. That was awful. Come on, people are going to think we're having too good of a time. There's so many people out there like, God, they were just talking about the issues, and now where are we?
Yep.
We're in the land of fat and cats.
Marin's glomming.
The glob of Marin has just oozed out of this. All right, here we go. I didn't even know where I was going with that. Palm Pilot. Ramon came in wearing a Cossack uniform. What do you make of that? It's a big day for President Bush. It's the last day of his European trip, and he has a big sit-down with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and I guess that's why Ramon was wearing that, because we've got his Palm Pilot in Russia here. 7 a.m., wake up in Bratislava. Last day of charm offensive. Note, this was a huge success. We've gone from contempt to mild disdain. 9 a.m., call Gerhard Schroeder. Thank him for the warm welcome yesterday. Tell him Germany has the best-behaved, hate-filled protesters in Europe. 10 a.m., meet with Putin. Get tough. Nickname change. Replace Pootie Poot with more warlike Putinator.
Oh, God.
11 a.m. Tell Putin that the idea of the U.S. invading Iran is simply ridiculous, unless he kicks in some troops. And then it would be simply fantastic. 12:30 p.m. Accuse Putin of restricting democracy by abolishing the election of provincial governors, pursuing a legal vendetta against the Yukos oil company, and tightening the Kremlin's grip on the media. Tell him that it is absolutely outrageous that he would launch such a vicious attack on the civil rights of a defenseless oil company. Outrageous.
Oh.
3 p.m. Quietly make deal with Putin to exchange angry rhetoric every 3 months to keep the money flowing to my pals in the defense industry. The defense industry. 5 p.m. after meeting, tell reporters, I've looked into Putin's eyes and seen the soul of a man I could trust and a man who could snap me like a twig. 7 p.m. He's an evil little guy, looking guy. I don't want to say he's, I don't want, man, maybe he's evil. Of course he is. They're all evil. 7 p.m. Board aircraft carrier in flight suit and declare that major charm offensive operations in Europe have ended. That's it. That's it for the AWOL fake Christian blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult. But you know what? They're losing momentum. I love it. I hope we see a progressive evolvement into a lame duck president. Because what's going on now in response to Social Security, I find to be rather encouraging, Mark Riley, in a couple of ways.
Well, yeah, it is encouraging because this plan, which a lot of people weren't sure was going to fly anyway, seems to have pitted conservative group against conservative group while Bush is over in Slovakia being translated to an adoring audience, apparently. I don't know. They applauded when he stopped talking, so and then they had the translator come out and tell him what he really said. But what we see going on now is a fight between two different conservative organizations. And what's interesting to me about this, Mark, right off the top, is that they describe one of them, the Cato Institute, not as a conservative organization, but as a libertarian organization.
Well, that was always sort of the issue about, the people that border on libertarianism, you know, these fiscal conservatives, these small government people are growing more disappointed and distraught with the Bush presidency.
Well, they are getting more and more upset with the Bush presidency, and they are also upset with the tactics of the organization that put out that hit ad on the AARP.
That was on
USA Next.
Right, USA Next on the American Prospect? American Spectator?
No, Spectator.
American Prospect's one of the good guys, right?
That's Tomasky.
Yes, American Spectator, one of the bad guys.
Yes.
And they put an ad that was associating the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons, with supporting gay marriage and being against our troops.
Yeah.
And they had an image of it. They had, like, an image of a soldier with an X through it and two men kissing with,
with a
yay.
Yeah. Now, let me say this. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with being in favor of gay marriage. I'm in favor of gay marriage. All right, so let's stake out a little bit of turf here, because when it comes to running to the center, I'm not prepared to run to the center on that specific issue.
But it just seems like, I think what the Cato Institute is probably criticizing him for is where the hell did that come from? I mean, it's just so clearly a slanderous assault on an association of people that have reasonable problems with a Bush policy, so they just want to drag these people through the mud.
Well, let's listen to Michael Tanner, director a quote from Michael Tanner, director of health and welfare studies at the Cato Institute. Quote, this is not very bright politics. Introducing homophobia and other things that are not relevant to Social Security reform is not helpful. And, of course, AARP says it has taken no position on same-sex marriage. But Charlie Jarvis, and I don't know why an organization like USA Next would have a, you know, again, one of those guys, his name is Charlie, just like the guy, the Republican that ran in Washington was named Dino.
Right.
Very strange names for these guys. Anyway, he's the president of USA Next, and he's not backing down. He's saying he's going to make sure that his membership, all five of them, know very clearly the position that AARP takes on same-sex marriage.
Well, these guys are, you know, these guys are propaganda distributors for the neocon death cult. These are the same guys, right, that were behind the Swift boat ads. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, what these guys do is they assume this, like, autonomy from the administration, and they say they're doing it, you know, because of their own reasons. But, you know, this is all part of the Rovian, you know, scheme. You know, this is all part of, you know, mobilizing these units, these propaganda units that they have on call, these whores that are willing to do the bidding for the administration. And why he doesn't have anything to lose by not backing down, that guy. What is he? He's worthless.
Because it's part of an overall strategy,
right,
Mark, that says convince him if you can, scare him if you must.
Right. Well, they're trying to, you know, to sort of, you know, pound the frame into people's heads that this is bad. You know, that they've already, you know, they succeeded that there was a high percentage of people that might have thought that it was in crisis, but no one thought that it should be changed. You know, and that's good. There's hope there because, you know, crisis is not what it's in. You know, it could use, you know, some restructuring as time goes on, but the plan is fine as it is, and that's a reality supported by smart economists, not people that are whores for the neocon death cult.
And, see, at the same time this is going on, this fight between USA Next and the Cato Institute, the Campaign for America's Future, which is a progressive advocacy group, is going after the Republican chair of the House Social Security Subcommittee, saying essentially that Congressman Jim McCreary of Louisiana accepted nearly $200,000 in contributions over 4 years from security firms and banks that could benefit from the Social Security privatization scheme.
But what I like, though, is the other side of this story, Riley, if I'm not jumping the gun too much here, is that, you know, you have unions. This, to me, this was like, this is one of those stories that I read. It was like reading the text of Howard Dean's first speech as DNC committee chair, where there was a moment in it where I'm like, oh, that's it. That's where we can hit them, you know. And this was one of those moments where I read about these unions who are taking brokerage houses to task. That you got to figure, you know, the AFC, I always say.
AFL-CIO.
Yeah, yes. That them and other unions who have pension funds invested with brokerage houses are saying to these brokerage houses, look, if you're going to get behind this plan, we're against you. We're pulling our pension out. And this has got to be a tremendously large amount of the brokerage business is wrapped up in these union pension plans. And, you know, of all kinds. So if the unions actually get together again, they could actually take a fairly, you know, significant political action against these brokerage houses and buckle them. Because we had a report last week that said that, you know, these brokerage houses were nervous because they didn't want to misinvest or get accused of improper investing by seniors groups. But this, I think, is really what was going on.
This is the money. This is the pocketbook issue. You know, people a lot of times think that, you know, the labor movement and the financial markets wouldn't have a whole heck of a lot in common. The fact is, Mark, that for years, for decades, for a couple generations now, unions have invested their money in such a way that these folks, these different financial markets, can no longer ignore the huge amount of teachers union pensions, Teamsters union pensions, sheet metal workers union pensions.
I love it.
They represent billions upon billions of dollars, and financial institutions get rich investing the money for them. Whether they win or lose.
Yep. I just love the fact that, you know, after everyone's saying, like, the unions are over, the unions are this and the unions are that, is that all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, well, I think that's blackjack. It's 44 past the hour. We'll be back after this.
Morning Sedition is more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com. Morning Sedition, on the air.
And online.
Listen at the office at morningsedition.com.
America Radio.
Right past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition with Mark Riley.
Yes.
How do you like that? How do you like that rock and roll music? So there you go. There's the fax machine. Is it working all right?
Oh, yeah.
There it comes. All right. That's the fax from the Liberal Agenda, from the Streisand compound. Here's the Liberal Agenda for today. Here are your marching orders. Write these down, my friends. One, stage a symbolic non-burning burning of the Pope's new book. Come on. Two, 4 days until the Oscars. Ladies, make sure all that rain hasn't caused your Vera Wang gown to mildew. Check it. Check that closet. I feel bad for the rain. My house apparently did not slide down the hill, Riley.
That's good.
Yeah. Three, my wife, on the other hand, did. She's still missing. I'm kidding. Three, make sure the upcoming bird flu epidemic is free range, because that's important to have free range virus. Hello. Hello. Is this on? All right. Four, download stolen numbers from Paris Hilton's cell phone book that were posted on the internet and make some fundraising calls for MoveOn.org. Those are our people, the new people. Five, today's phrase is dropping the conversation. Bush in Germany, man? That's like the chickens coming home to roost. You know what I'm saying. Wake up and smell the jackfruit, sheeple.
Ooh.
All right, so moving back, Riley, into Social Security, there's a myth going on about, you know, this idea of all the arguments for cutting and privatizing Social Security, the most obnoxious and misleading focus on the alleged greed of senior citizens, present and future, that they're accusing senior citizens of what? Amassing too much money, taking up too much air, and there's some interesting arguments that, you know, I'm still trying to parse here that you may help me. For 20% of retirees, every penny of their income comes from Social Security.
In the black community, that number rises to 44%.
So 44% of that 20 are the black community. Is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is that in the black community,
yes,
among the community of black retirees,
yeah,
it's not 20% where every penny comes from Social Security.
Right.
It is 44%.
Got it. So for nearly 65% of retirees, Social Security provides half or more of their income. Now that's I know people like that. You know what I mean? I know that, you know, not my mom, you know, relies on some of her Social Security money. You know, she's got a real estate business and some pension. But, you know, it's important. Okay. Now in the year 2000, only 29% of seniors received income from private pensions. 29%, that's a low number. An additional 14% of seniors received income from government employee pensions. Okay.
Now, let me stop you there for one quick second,
okay,
if I might. Because I don't want to lose the pension.
Absolutely.
Thing. People's pensions, Mark Maron, have been going up in smoke over the last 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
People who thought they had money in pensions, people who invested it during the tech boom and all of that, a lot of people have seen chunks of their retirement money float off into space like something off a booster rocket.
Because of book cooking corporate entities, you know, criminals, CEO criminals who have been entitled by the Bush administration, and the lies that go on and how money is represented and what money is really there. You know, a lot of people lost fortunes, not fortunes, but pensions.
No, fortunes. You're right.
Right.
Fortunes.
In when their mutual funds involved Enron, or that their investor, their broker recommended that they put their pension in these private things. And there's no saying that this wouldn't happen if they privatized, or whatever they're talking about, casino-wise Social Security. But the reason this is interesting is that some of the suggestions is around, you know, these retirees that have a substantial amount of money, and the pulling back of the estate tax entitles them to more money. And some of this tax has to come back in. You know, it has to come back in, Riley, if I'm reading this article correctly. When Bush pushed the reduction of the dividend tax, he bragged about its impact on the elderly, saying, "We are helping seniors who rely on dividends." All right. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says 2.5% of elderly people would receive almost half of the benefits from the dividend exemption. They all have incomes exceeding $200,000.
Yeah.
So this is a tax cut that benefits wealthy retirees. What do we do with all these people that rely on Social Security, and if it's privatized, will be left in the lurch, yet they're rich get richer in this, even in the retirement community?
This is, again, a form of social Darwinism. This is being described, by the way, in a Tuesday article by E.J. Dion, who I greatly respect, and I really enjoy his work. One of the things that you have to understand about how the Bush administration is trying to push through this privatization scheme is to divide the American public up demographically, so that on the one hand, they have these little dummy groups that are supposed to represent seniors that want the private accounts.
Mm-hmm.
even though seniors are generally resistant to the private accounts because they believe that there's going to be a cut in benefits no matter what Bush says.
Mm-hmm.
So their strategy then is to reach out to younger people. And how do you reach out to younger people? By portraying the baby boom generation, the generation that's about to retire in the next decade, as being greedy and sucking all the air out of the room and taking the younger people's benefits right along with them.
Yeah, yeah. You know your grandmother, kid? She's stealing your money.
Yep. That's exactly what they're trying to say.
Can you explain to me a little bit about this, you know, this portrayal? Like, I mean, obviously, that you just did, that, you know, that not all seniors have their own money.
Not all seniors, no. And the thing is, yeah, there are a lot of seniors that invested wisely over time, that had enough money to invest wisely over time, but there are a lot of other seniors who need some modicum of Social Security to augment whatever their pensions are. And many Americans get very feeble pensions, Mark. Can you imagine trying to live in New York City on, for example, $400 or $500 a month?
Can you imagine trying to live anywhere? I mean, yeah, for $400, $500 a month, where the hell are you going to live for that? I'm always amazed sometimes when I go out of town into, you know, like even, you know, into you know, smaller cities where you look at, like, yeah, you can buy that house for $175,000. I'm like, really? Can I move it to New York? You know what I mean? Can I buy it and put it on a trailer? But, I mean, but that low amount of money, that, you know, you're talking about how you're going to eat, how you're going to, you know, have any entertainment, how you're going to pay for your medicine, how you're going to, you know, get basic needs met, how you're going to get your housing met. I mean, these are questions that American seniors ask daily. I mean, you're talking for 20% of retirees, every penny of their income coming from Social Security, you know, that cannot be tampered with. That these people cannot be made to look like criminals.
No, they shouldn't be made to look like criminals. But the fact is, the only way the Bush people see of pushing this thing through is to make them look greedy, to make them look like they're going to be the ones making out like bandits, while the younger generation is going to get stuck with the
tax. What kind of sick bastard is these people? What kind, like the neocon death cult? Are they, have they no shame whatsoever? Are they? It's just evil. It's evil stuff, Mark.
It's now, strategy. It's social Darwinism.
I know.
It's saying, look, put them out on an ice floe if we have to. Put them out in the Hudson. Let them fend for themselves.
Yeah, it's also like, dude, they're going to be dead soon.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, if we can just push this a couple of years, that number's going to drop off. I mean, it's 20% now, but think about it. If they're just making the $500 a month and they're eating that bad food, and since we put this Medicare plan in, they can barely get their medicine, this problem's going to solve itself inside 2 years. You know what I mean? See, there goes another one.
There goes another one.
Hey, wait, here's one's coming to the table. Hey, that's right. Let me just, is that your $500 a month check? Oh, I'm sorry. It's red. Oh, what's the matter? Is something wrong with your chest?
Oh. See? Now,
the problem is solving itself. Social Darwinism.
But people don't realize, too, sooner or later, some economists are going to start figuring out how much people would stand to lose if there was a, for example, 5 or 10 or 15% downturn in the stock market.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
What happens then?
Yeah.
All of these projections are based on a certain level of economic growth. Suppose that doesn't happen.
Hey, I'm going to ask a question out there for all you rich Democrats and you wealthy progressives and you overly abundant liberals. Are you willing to pay taxes? What does it mean to be on the left? What are our values? Are you willing to pay all the taxes that are expected of you? Good question, right, Riley?
It is an excellent question. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to go inside the mind of suicide bombers on Air America Radio.
All right, what is it, Thursday at 6:20. Why did I say 6? It's 20 past the hour.
No, it's not.
It's 7. It's 6 past the hour. All right. 6 past the hour, morning tradition.
Get a drink.
I'm sorry. I didn't think you were paying attention because you're eating. Why don't you eat those rice cakes? Our friends in Hawaii sent us all these rice crackers.
They are addicting, those rice crackers.
Right, but Chris has eaten 90 of them. How many can you eat before you realize? Like, I know they feel like you're not gaining any weight, but I'm literally watching you get fat.
This weight thing, man, you guys are...
Here's what happened with the clock. Okay, I look at the 59. See, I just looked at. So something wrong. See, it's 7 past the hour right now. Okay, that's all I'm going to say. You know, whatever time was it, what it was when I said it here in New York, that doesn't apply to anybody else out there in the world. If you're wondering, if you're getting in your car, you're getting ready to work. 7 past the hour right now. It's Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. This is like tomorrow will be the last time you hear me do, you know, sound checks. or not sound checks, time checks in Boulder, Colorado. Tomorrow we are. It's our last day in Boulder, Riley. I'm sorry. We've had a great time. I enjoyed being in your homes and in your cars and in your ears and in your heads every day. But Clear Channel's made a decision, my friends, and they're going.
But remember, we're not gone completely. We just pushed back.
Whatever. They were pushed back into the strange dark hours. We're pushed back into the baker's hours, and we love bakers, but we need more than just bakers. But Jay Marvin is your guy now, and I hope you enjoy that, because that's what the programmers have done for you. We're going to miss you. You can still get us streaming, and you can still get us on XM and Sirius. There's many ways you can get us.
Podcasting.
Podcasting is also good. You can go download our show and listen into it on your iPod. And be careful with the iPod. It will take over your life.
MorningsEdition.com will tell you how you can hear us.
That's right. And also, you know, we're very excited. We got some national ratings here, Riley. Close to 1 million people are listening to Morning Sedition on a daily basis across the country, which ain't bad for being on the air less than a year.
Yes.
And, you know, going through what we've gone through here on this show.
Yes.
We're doing okay. We are the third most listened to show on Air America, the Air America proper.
Yes.
You know, some people, there are some people that aren't exactly under the umbrella of the network. But
they're kind of half out in the rain and half under the umbrella.
Well, yeah. Well, they're carried, you know, on the same, you know, network. They're carried on the same affiliates, but they're not necessarily produced. The ones that are produced here in-house are, you know, Randy and Al and myself.
Yeah.
And Janine's show and, you know, Malloy and Unfiltered show for some people, you know.
Oh, you're talking about some of the others.
Huh?
Others?
Yeah. Like Ed Schultz is not produced here in New York.
You blaspheme.
What do you mean?
No, I'm not.
But a lot of people get a different mixture of shows.
I know, they do. They definitely do.
Look, also, I want to say hello to my friends in Albuquerque, New Mexico, because I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tonight, they're celebrating in Albuquerque the life of one of my personal heroes, Gus Blaisdell, who owned a bookstore down by the university. They're doing a little thing where they're going to have anecdotes, poems, films, foods, and whatnot. That's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I grew up, at the Outpost Performance Space tonight at 7:30 p.m. How do you like that? A little shout-out to my hometown.
There you go, your homies. In Albuquerque.
Singing the praise of Gus Blaisdell, who changed my life and mind irrevocably, irreparably, for the better, my friend. Yeah.
So, I've heard you mention him before.
Yeah, I wrote about him in my book as well. Now, what else are we going into this hour? This is going to be an intense hour. You know, right now I want to talk about the difference between left and right and how few people know the actual difference. But at the bottom of this hour, we are going to have some people on that wrote a book. They spent time with suicide bombers,
yes,
with the cult of suicide bombers, with Hamas, with the language of suicide bombers. And this is the book is creepy to me. It's
frightening.
Intense. Yeah. I mean, I opened it up and I'm like, literally, I felt something dark, you know, emanating from the book. But let's talk about the right and left issue. 37% of Americans think liberals oppose gun control, or else they are not sure if liberals oppose gun control. 27% thought a right-winger was someone who supported affirmative action. 78% of respondents believe conservatives support moral values, while only 40% said the same about left-wingers. In fact, 29% said they believed left-wingers actually opposed moral values. Respondents were asked to define the labels according to what their positions were on seven political issues: abortion rights, gun control, cutting taxes, gay rights, same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and moral values. Now, the point here being is that the etymology of the left goes back into some pretty demonic stuff. All right, that there's so few people that actually understand, you know, the principles or core values of the progressives, the Democrats, the left, you know, or an amalgamation of those three things. And even to the point where some days I'm not sure I understand what all of them are. And I can't be alone in that, because it is a big sort of not argument, but discussion that, you know, there are so many people on the left that are put in the position to react, as opposed to proact, as opposed to, you know, have discussions about philosophy, about values. We're too busy trying to reframe, to, you know, to address their language, to, you know, change these little things, you know, piecemeal, without really assessing what our core values are, Riley.
Well, see, that is unfortunately our curse as progressives. We end up in situations where, no matter how we try to put it in terms that don't reflect this, we end up reacting to the actions of others. And sooner or later, we're going to have a long discussion on the left about how to break that cycle. Because without being able to act, without being able to be the people that start the discussion, not just the people that chime in after somebody else has.
And also, we fight amongst ourselves as well in a very big way, because we're all sort of like, you know, everything has to be exactly how we think it is for our little, you know, section of the cause world. You know, I want to engage some callers. I'd like them to define themselves. What are the left's values in your mind? And what do we need to do? 866-303-2270 is our number if you want to have some input in this. Because obviously what we talk about here on a day-to-day basis, at least a little bit, you know, some of the issues are obviously, you know, reproductive freedom is an issue that we are, you know, are, you know, part of our core values is to ensure reproductive freedom, to ensure, you know, working health care for all people. We are very, sort of emphatic about a separation between church and state. We would like to place people before corporate entities. We would like to stop the restricting of victim rights through the evil tort reform measures that the right is trying to take. We would like to have a foreign policy that is embracing as opposed to off-putting. These are issues that have been part of the core values of liberals for a long time.
I have a couple of my own, which include, by the way, being absolutely unalterably opposed to the death penalty under any circumstances, and I don't believe in any abridgment of the First Amendment under any circumstances. Those are just two little things for me, and by the way, I also don't believe in any backing up whatsoever, for example, from issues of dealing with racism, dealing with homophobia, dealing with these different ills in society. I am not prepared, just me now, I'm not prepared to compromise to try and win some mythical group of voters who may not think the same way. For me, a lot of this stuff is a deal breaker.
Absolutely, and even some of the language in this poll is a little questionable, like moral values. I mean, who doesn't want moral values? The question is where do those values come from? What is morality? That's actually a Republican frame to create issues like that. Are moral values possible in a secular world? Of course they are.
Yes.
It's just that these idiots dominate the conversation with regressive, biblical, you know, religious values. They can operate fine without the religion, which goes into the church and state separation, the necessity of that. We can't let this country be hijacked by, you know, jingoistic religious fanatics or people that want to deplete the planet of everything in the name of money.
It's unbelievable that they've been able to find common ground, these religious fanatics and these corporate greedmeisters, so that they are now operating in lockstep to not just abridge the rights of those of us who disagree with them, but to actually dominate the discussion and therefore dominate the direction of the country.
That's right. So we're going to take some calls, 866-303-2270, with some of your input about what you think are the most important progressive values, and can we all get along on our own side enough to make a ideological momentum happen? Can we? 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. We can't do it without you. Call 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. This is Morning Sedition.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's the Morning Sedition program you're listening to. We're soliciting calls from people who are, you know, have some ideas about what the difference between left and right is. What are the left's values? What are the democratic values that we're constantly talking about, yet not so completely clear on all the time? What differentiates us? You know, it turns out, after reading this survey about people who know the difference between left and right, just how few people know anything or seem to care about the momentum of politics at all. That would be the 70 million or so people that did not vote. So here's the phone number is 866-303-2270. Is it time for that right now?
Oh,
my God.
No. Yes, it is.
Yeah, let me read you my dream from last night. Okay, here we go. You ready for this? I'm in the Galapagos Islands in a paradise of various life forms. Everywhere are flightless cormorants and iguanas and penguins and sea lions and finches and three different species of boobies. Charles Darwin shows up carrying an umbrella and riding a giant tortoise. He says, "Evolution's not a theory, Mark. It's a fact. Look around you. Those intelligent design people are superstitious quacks. I mean, come on. There are three different species of boobies here." I look across the horizon and spot a strange kind of humanoid. I ask, "Hey, Charles, what's that?" He says, "It's a primitive version of Mark Maron. Note the distrustful eyes, the sullen demeanor, the wide gills and spiky tail. It's me at 18 and I'm drinking a beer. I start to approach it. Darwin says, "Be careful, Mark. That one has been known to snap a stranger's head clean off. But oddly, its worst enemy seems to be itself." I see another me up ahead. I ask, "What about that one?" It's me at 30, only with a bright green head and webbed feet and a long sticky tongue. Darwin says, "That's a curious species of Marin. It writes poetry and then later, in a rage, he destroys what he's written. Then at night, he goes out on the rocks and entertains the sea lions. His sets are solid, though. I give him that." Then I see a species of me who looks exactly like me now, only he's all mellow and happy and has three sleepy eyes. Darwin says, "In the absence of natural predators, this one lost all his defense mechanisms. Mostly he just eats grass and naps and masturbates." I go up to him and I say, "Dude, can I crash on your couch?" I woke up and my bed was filled with protective coloration. Now we're going to blast through these calls of people who have some ideas or have some thoughts on what the left and the Democrats are, you know, what it all means. I'm not going to be rude, but I want to get as many calls in as possible. Ron in Northern Kentucky, good morning.
Hey, Ron.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I think we need to have our own Democratic brand. When we stand as Democrats stand up and talk about family values or values, all we're doing is reinforcing their brand.
Right.
We need our own, such as American beliefs, American principles, mm-hmm. American ways. We need to do these because I know in the speeches I've heard recently from Howard Dean,
yeah.
John Edwards, et cetera, where they stand up behind a podium and talk about it's Democrats. We believe, we believe, we believe.
Yeah, we're on it, man. We're on it, Ron. Okay, I'm writing that down. Branding. Good. Onward. Dave in Seattle. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I'm similar with Ron because if you were to hold both sides down, both sides would say, like, oh, you know, we believe in, you know, justice, liberty, freedom. You know, the thing is, when a progressive says justice, it means competent legal representation. Mm. People can't afford it. You know, when a conservative says justice, it means a quick execution. You know, when we say
right.
freedom, you know, it means, you know, not sticking your neighbor, knows your neighbor's business. When they say freedom, it means bombing another country for our corporate interests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we say liberty, it means, you know, you should have the right to pursue anything that's not affecting others. When they say liberty, it means bomb a country for corporate interests.
Right.
And that needs to be... We can use the same terms, family values. We need to state them, though. And of course, we believe in families. But then you got to walk away from the podium because when they keep holding you there and pressing you with these points, then it gets all gobbledygooked, and then it goes, "Oh, they're waffling."
Clarity. Clarity is what you're looking for. Thank you, Dave. Thank you for the planned. That was good. He had that all worked out for us. Pablo, listening in Miami. Good morning.
Hey, Pablo.
Hey, morning, guys. How you doing?
All right.
Listen, our moral values on the left really are really simple. We believe in social justice, economic equality, social equality. And you know what? In terms of being pro-life, as a Catholic, my church says to be pro-life. But you know what? That means to be against abortion, against war, and against the death penalty. And I find it hypocritical on a lot of people on the right that choose one of those three for political reasons. So I think we have the moral high ground. We just can't lose sight of that and stay together. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Pablo.
All right, thanks, Pablo.
Nice.
Don, to the point.
Yeah, Don in my hometown of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good morning. What's on your mind, sir?
Hey, Don.
Who?
Don in Albuquerque? No?
Don, can you hear us, Don?
Okay, moving on. Roxy in Seattle. Good morning, Roxy.
Hi, Roxy.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's going on?
Well, I think that basically the reason I'm a liberal is because I have a real strong sense that, you know, a fairness. And not everybody is born with equal opportunity and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a phrase bandied about called liberal guilt.
Yes.
And I prefer to think of it as liberal gratitude.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yes.
I never thought about it like that. I'm going to have to process that because, you know, I definitely have, that's a good spin on liberal guilt, liberal gratitude. It's hard. I'm going to have to work on that on the break. That's the kind of thing that makes me go gratitude, guilt. How do those things, we have no time for that right now. I got to, Mark, you got to take another call. You're going to have to, you know, parse what she said in your mind on the break. Roxy, thank you. Stan in St. Paul, Minnesota. Good morning.
Hey, Stan.
Hey, great show. Fantastic. Thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, I just want to say it's a matter of workers. Labor creates all wealth, and all workers should get to share in the equal economic benefits of their labor.
Right.
I think it all boils down to that first, and all other things emanate from that.
Okay.
The economic end of the spectrum.
Well, thank you very much, Stan. That's interesting because we were talking about unions earlier in the show about them taking, you know, using some, you know, financial leverage to buckle the brokerage industry from, you know, admitting or, you know, jumping on board with President Bush's Social Security plan. I hope that the unions re-strengthen themselves and get more active. Don't you, Riley?
Oh, I absolutely do, and I hope that unions get to represent more people because there are more people in America that have 401ks than belong to unions.
That's right. So, look, we got some heavy subject matter coming up next. We're going to talk to the writers of Road to Martyr Square. They spent some time writing a book among the Hamas, among the suicide bombers. It's dark but interesting stuff. We'll be back. Thank you for your calls. It's 27 past the hour.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
And now, the Morning Tradition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
We last left Mark at Agent Henriette Mantell's penthouse apartment above Washington, D.C. Bill Clinton and Barbara Boxer had told him about their efforts to take down the Shadow Government. We join Mark now after a night alone with Henriette.
When I woke up the next morning, the bed was as empty as a Sunni ballot box. Agent Mantell was gone. She left a message written in lipstick on the mirror. All it said was,
Mark, go to Bush's Crawford, Texas ranch. If you knock on the front door of the blacksmith shop, you'll find a piece of the puzzle. Bush has been relying on it since the day, continued on bathroom mirror. He took office. I left you a plane ticket and traveling money on the dresser. I'll be in contact, but don't look for me. Your safety depends on it.
Money on the dresser? I felt used, dirty, taken advantage of, like a cheap whore who... Wow, that was a lot of money. I guess I was headed for Crawford. Crawford Ranch. So this is where the president spends 90% of his time. Guys like me don't fit in places like this, on some dusty street with nothing around. I felt more out of place than Laura Bush on an anti-gang task force. I knocked on the door of the blacksmith shop, like Henriette told me. And it happened. The entire front of one of the Western-style buildings fell down, revealing nothing. It was all a facade, a Western movie set. And standing behind it was Jeff Gannon himself, dressed in a Marine outfit with the crotch cut out.
What are you doing here, Marin?
Gannon, or should I say, Guckert. I'm not surprised to see you hiding behind a facade. That's what you do best. How do you know my name? I don't hire male escorts.
I know your name because that's a reporter's job.
Like I said, how do you know my name?
We're going to teach you not to stick your nose where it doesn't belong.
Who's we?
Let me introduce you to some friends of mine.
Out from behind another false front stepped an Indian chief, a policeman, and a cowboy. They lined up right in front of me. I hadn't seen anything that ridiculous since I read Bush's plans for Social Security. Let me guess. It takes a village, people.
You're fast with wisecracks, peepers. Let's see how fast you learn your lesson. Hit it, Tex!
The cowboy started firing.
Dance, you nosy liberal private dick! All right, now jazz dance! Now we want to see you do that turn again, but at the end, just go right in the step, shuffle ball chain instead of pausing for a beat.
You mean like this?
Yeah, that's it. Actually, let's see you try a leap there instead of a simple step.
Come on, Gannon. Spill it. Why is there a fake ranch here? If the president doesn't spend 90% of his time here, where has he been?
You're a smart guy. You would have figured it out eventually. Too bad you won't live long enough. Now, do a handspring into a split.
That I can do!
Yeah!
Hop on, partner!
Howard Dean!
The resistance has got your back, Mark!
Your days are numbered, Marin! And I haven't seen anyone with that little rhythm since Colin Powell!
Did he say Colin Powell?
Hey, what's that stencil on the side of that fake house?
Inauguration Studios, Hollywood, USA!
I've heard that name before.
You're going to Hollywood, Mark. It's becoming part of the shadow government's conservative media conspiracy.
But what can I do about it?
You've got to help out some friends of the resistance out there. Important people. Liberal show business people. Also, your agent is sending you out on an audition. It's a sitcom where you go to college with a monkey.
Really? A monkey? That might be good.
Where has Bush been instead of Crawford Ranch? What will Mark find in Hollywood? And did he remember to bring headshots and a resume? And did Jeff Gannon really have to have the crotch cut out of his uniform? Was that strictly necessary? Find out next time when we hear Jeff Gannon say,
"Is there a draft in my pants, or am I just happy to see myself?" You get it? Because I've got a big hole in my... Make him dance, Tex!
That's next time on The Shadow Government. And stay tuned later for Morning Sedition Radio Theater's remake of the Orson Welles classic radio stunt, The Alien Invasion from The War of the Worlds.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have an urgent announcement. Stay in your homes. Keep your doors closed. Do not look out your window. Stay off the highways and all public transportation. Keep your children close by. If you're driving in an automobile right now, pull over and park. Ladies and gentlemen...
Riley, what are you doing? Are you trying to trick people into thinking there's an alien invasion?
No! I want to be home in 15 minutes to watch the Jerry Springer Show, and I don't want to hit traffic. Ladies and gentlemen, I have an urgent announcement. Stay in your homes.
That's coming up later on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
All right, 39 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition. That was, of course, Morning Sedition Radio Theater, which is getting more and more peculiar. But funny.
Yes.
Our guests in studio have written a book that I picked up the other day. I was afraid to pick up the book. It was sitting on my desk, and I was like, oh, my God, am I going to be able to handle this? The book is The Road to Martyr Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. And when I picked this book up and started looking at the pictures of the graffiti and these trading cards, which we're going to talk to them about, you know, I felt haunted. The authors lived for 6 months with a Palestinian refugee family in the Gaza Strip at the beginning of the first Intifada from 1987 until 1993. They are research scholars in global and international studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. They are former visiting scholars at the Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard. So we are pleased to have them in our studio today, Anne Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg. The book is The Road to Martyr Square. So I read the introduction. Fascinating. Now, how did you get into this? Because it's a very circuitous way to start to assess the graffiti and whatnot. I found that very interesting.
Well, it was easy in some ways. I mean, if you were in the occupied territories, or if you were in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip during the Intifada, you couldn't help but notice the graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
It covered literally every surface, I mean, everything. Houses, doors, cars, plants, everything had been covered with graffiti.
What was significant about it? It was graffiti put there by...
Yeah, quite early on, we started taking pictures of the graffiti and translating it, and we realized that this was giving us an entree into the Intifada that was not afforded other researchers. The reason that this was that the graffiti we came to realize was an internal system of communications. It was put up by young Palestinian activists for other young Palestinian activists or for the Palestinian population at large. It was not meant to be read by outsiders, and we were probably the only people who were around who were paying attention to it and studying it.
I mean, there were Palestinian media, such as newspapers, but they were controlled by a Palestinian elite. That was the first problem. The second problem was that they were censored by the Israeli government.
So this is like, this is how there's a secret, almost like a, like in The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon, there was a secret way of communicating with each other. Now, you spent time, you know, with suicide bombers, and in this, what fascinated me was all the different media that they used to sort of, there is a cult feel to these people.
There is a cult feel to these people, and the, as the Intifada evolved, the media evolved also, was it just graffiti, which was the first major means of communication? There were martyr cards, there were murals, posters, audio cassettes, videotapes, a plethora of media out there. In fact, the media became so sophisticated by the end that a videotape of, say, the last will and testament of a suicide bomber or a group of suicide bombers would even include a coming announcement, a coming attraction announcement of the next suicide bomber video that you could buy. And this kind of commodification of the phenomenon was actually very interesting. You could also go into the souk or the marketplace and buy a plaque that was ready-made for you if you had a martyr in your family, and you would simply paste a photograph of your beloved dead into the, you know, available slot, had the appropriate Quranic quotations and
so disturbing.
So, so the whole process was by the end of the first Intifada, intensely even commodified.
Mm. It seems as though, certainly I think to a lot of Americans, it's kind of difficult to fathom what would lead someone to take their own life in service of a particular cause. Should Americans think of suicide bombers, for example, and kamikaze pilots as two sides of the same coin, or is there a different catalyst, a different things driving suicide bombers in the Middle East?
Well, they're commonly cited motivations for people to become suicide bombers. These include everything from the Israeli occupation, nationalism, religion, glory, fame, paradise, money, power. I mean, these, you know, youth took these very old scripts, very long-standing scripts.
What does that mean in scripts? Because how do you define that?
By script, we mean, you know, we mean the filmic metaphor, a program for thought, behavior, and action.
Okay.
You can plug into the script whenever you need it. It's a ready-made script, and you don't have to think anymore.
Who transmits the script?
Well, these scripts that we study are actually long-standing scripts. They were there 36, 48, the 60s. Back to even Ottoman times. We have graffiti that go back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Example of a script? Like, what are some of the points of a script?
Well, the suicide bombing script has a lot to do with motivations of glory and immortality, and also of fame. You can't overestimate that or underemphasize that.
So you'll be on a T-shirt and you get 72 versions.
Yeah.
There's a huge movie star factor here.
Oh,
it's not a sex symbol factor.
Oh, my God.
These people were movie stars in their culture.
There were a number of different systems of indoctrination that were existing at the same time. First of all, you lived in a supersaturated environment. This is what I alluded to earlier, where I was talking about every surface was being covered, not just with graffiti, but people were creating these martyr videos. There were Intifada tapes playing. There were public spectacles. There were demonstrations. You were in the process of being indoctrinated without knowing it, much like the society we live in here. Parallel to that, there was a very purposeful system set up in order to cultivate and determine who were the best people who were to be candidates for carrying out these operations. And if you want to look at it that way, you can look at suicide bombing much like you look at a cult. The young people, mostly young men who became suicide bombers, had a very simple task, really. They were tasked to go out and die and kill as many people as possible in doing so. And that is a task that only certain types of people are liable to fill.
Okay, well, let's talk about those types of people. I want to talk to you about the suicide bomber that went out and failed that you talked to, and also a little bit about your experience, you know, in living among the suicide bombers. When we come back in a second, we're talking to Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg. The book is The Road to Martyrs Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
50 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there.
Good morning.
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition. We're talking to Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg, the authors of The Road to Martyrs Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. For me, it's very hard, even you know, on the break I was talking to you about, it's very hard for me to humanize this behavior in any way. It's very hard for me to not be completely haunted and disturbed and angry about it. And you spent time with not only the suicide bombers, but you know, in these communities in Gaza, and you got to know people, and you were part of the community, I imagine, for a while. That must have been must have brought up a lot of conflict in yourself.
Yes, there was a lot of internal conflict. How do you handle this? We had this vast archive of political ephemera and underground media in the Intifada. We feared it would be appropriated and misappropriated. How are we to handle this without further romanticizing the figure of the suicide bomber, in and of itself a highly romantic figure? This was quite a task. We struggled with that for a long time. In fact, anybody who seriously thinks about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there has to be moments when you're reduced to utter silence. That is, in fact, the function of a suicide bombing, is to reduce people to silence. But the complexities are such that we were often reduced to silence. We struggled over how to deal with this phenomenon. I mean, part of the problem here is that the conflict is completely overdetermined. And by that, I mean that the people there cannot possibly bear the symbolic weight that is exerted upon them, not only by themselves, but by the external world, the whole world, actually, who looks upon this conflict as a great Manichaean drama of good and evil being played out.
It's an international
in a place
symbol,
the size
right.
of a postage stamp.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're not talking about just a territorial war here. It's a war of symbols, and both sides realize that, and the whole world realizes that.
Mm-hmm.
This puts particular burdens on the people there. They can't possibly bear the sheer weight.
Let's look at the political overtones of this for a brief moment, if we can. In the United States, the general feeling has been that organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, and with the sanction of, until recently, the Palestinian Authority, are responsible for the care, feeding, and nurturing of suicide bombers. How responsible, in terms of your experience, how responsible are these organizations, and specifically the Palestinian Authority, which has seen a change in leadership and which now people are starting to think that they, you know, Sharon can actually work with Abbas? Does that make a difference to the people that are out here recruiting and caring and feeding for suicide bombers?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, the book is two things. One, it's a serious indictment of not only suicide bombing and the structures that led to suicide bombing, but also the surrounding political and cultural institutions that promoted it. We find that not only were mainstream Palestinian factions like Fatah, but responsible, but also I'd say there's a strong indictment against a tradition of Palestinian and wider Arab intellectuals who promoted a cult, a very destructive cult, which romanticized death and romanticize murder and death in the service of murder.
And that comes right out of those pictures, man. I mean, I looked at those pictures, and you can feel that emanating.
At the same time, the book is also about the very human experience that we had living in both Palestine and in Israel. And it is very much about the contradictions we felt when we had very close friends on both sides of the border. We would go back and forth across the borders, and it's just as much about how we came to come to terms with these deep contradictions, which we experienced for the 6 years we were living there, but the people who lived there experienced day in and day out. And it's actually, to get back to your question, Mark, that the challenge that's facing Abbas now is how he is going to be able, and the people around him are going to be able, to write new scripts, to get back to the idea of scripts, and to create new modes of thought for people who were caught up for generations in a process that led to what we think was the terribly, terribly, terrible curse that was brought upon them of promoting and valorizing not only the actions of the suicide bomber, but the person of the suicide
reframing
bomber.
The script.
Reframing the Intifada.
There you go.
That must be a difficult
thing. Yeah, so promises of economic prosperity and recognition aren't going to be enough.
Sure.
They're going to have to be alternative scripts that are as compelling as the old and offer people what the old did.
Right.
That is glory, money, fame, the opportunity to be heroic. This is what every adolescent wants to be, as a hero. When the scripts that your culture offers up are ones of violent death and martyrdom, then people are going to act on those scripts and literalize them.
It's almost inverted, the script that they're honoring now.
And this is a problem that goes far beyond the area. It's not an intrinsically Palestinian or Israeli phenomenon
Absolutely.
At all. I mean, part of the problem of 21st century life is what you could call the burden of individuation. And it's a very tough road to go toward being an individual. And people have to resist this kind of hive mind. You know,
yeah, that's a message that this country could yield to.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you before we run out of time about the failed suicide bomber. That sort of that story sort of fascinated me. This guy goes out, gets on a bus to kill people. The bomb doesn't go off. How is he looked at in the community? How does he feel about his impotence?
Well, he's achieved a mythic stature of sorts. He's become a living martyr, which is one of the paradigms of the movement.
Uh huh. That just means 1 minute. You're okay.
Okay. And we had a long conversation with him, and he was surrounded by his friends and his family. It's a very interesting part of the book because his family, for instance, would sway back and forth between trying to tell us that they had opposed his actions at the same time defending his actions and helping to make him a heroic figure. You could tell that they had two ideas going at the same time in their head, which is a terrible problem there. This kind of cognitive dissonance, this kind of schizophrenia that you're forced to live with.
Hmm.
At the same time, he had achieved, or he averred, and it seemed to be true, that he had achieved this deep happiness in himself. His last line to us, and I don't think he'd seen the movie, but seemed to be quoting the Lou Gehrig story. He said, you know, today, I'm the happiest man on the face of the earth. And
because he actually gets his cake and gets to eat it, too, on this plane.
He's a living martyr.
In his community. Well, you know, it's very provocative and profound stuff and disturbing stuff, and it's a beautifully written book. It's called The Road to Martyr Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. Anne Marie Oliver, Paul Steinberg, pleasure talking to you. Good luck with the book.
Thank you both.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
And we'll be back. We're going to talk about performance-enhancing drugs, but not just in baseball. All over. Right,
all
Riley?
Over. The history of same.
Oh.
And it's not just steroids anymore. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
What is it, Bob?
Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians. Good morning to the desperate, the despairing, the hopeless, the narcissistic. Don't end your lives. Stay with us. It's all going to be okay soon. By the end of the afternoon, my friends. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Good morning, Kalo. Don't worry about it, man. You look good. Yeah,
oh,
sure
here we go again.
Sure,
did we like fix all of that between the two of you in the 6 o'clock?
Kind
of.
You know, we covered so much stuff today, Riley. We talked about Social Security. We talked about unions. We talked about
Weight Watchers.
We talked about. We talked about No Child Left Behind. We got in a little bit about, you know, what is the left? What is the right? Do we know the difference? And we got into a little, and we talked about suicide bombers. That was, that was heavy, man. That book is heavy, you know, because I'll tell you something, man, as a Jew, you know, you're always, you know, as most people, you know, these guys are evil bastards. I mean, they go in, they're homicide. They're not suicide bombers. They're homicide bombers. They go and blow themselves up to kill people. And you read this book, which it is just, you just opening the book, some sort of haunted thing emanates from the page because you see all the sort of the trappings of what is almost a cult. And the way they sort of mirror the modern media in terms of making heroes and giving kids incentive to do this with trading cards, with, you know, with videos, with, you know, mythologizing within the community. And oh, it's very eerie. It's,
you know,
creepy stuff.
It's interesting because, Mark, the Israeli government has spent a long time and a lot of effort trying to convince specifically the Palestinian Authority, and I guess by inference Hamas and Hezbollah, to stop putting out that kind of literature. I didn't realize that it was graffiti, but I do know that there were, you know, there have been accusations of long standing that the Palestinians put out books and other literature that talks about the destruction of Israel, about the glory of martyrdom, about the glory of fighting the infidel, you know, all of that sort of thing.
I was just informed by Clutch Larson that Homicide Bomber is a right-wing frame. Apologize, didn't realize that. But, you know, this book, you know, outside of the politics, politics is, you know, is really a sort of, you know, look into that world and what turns these people into these killing machines. In shifting gears from that, I want to say goodbye to the people in Boulder. We've had fun. We're going to be on much earlier for less time. It was out of our hands. Clear Channel made a decision. They're going to have the local guy, that guy Marvin, is going to come in.
J. Marvin,
whatever. And, you know, we're going to miss
J. Marvin, whatever. Uh-oh.
Is it my starting a feud? You know, I began a feud yesterday with a writer for the Weekly Standard.
Is that what that's Stephen Schwartz.
I didn't start a feud. I don't care. You know, just the way he handled the Hunter S. Thompson obituary was despicable and revisionist and shallow. And it turns out that this guy is a self-hating douchebag, you know, who used to be a punk rocker, and his parents were leftists, communists, and he considered himself a communist, and then he evolved into some sort of social pariah within the punk community that they didn't even like him. And then apparently he was so lost and angry that he tended towards, you know, surrealist poetry and, you know, and sort of, you know, Marxist ramblings. And I guess right at the right time, some operative, or basically someone representing a conservative think tank in the Bay Area, said, oh, look at the lost angry fat boy. Hey,
wow.
How about a little free market mojo in your mind? And they basically converted him into what he is now, which is a shabby writer with no respect for what he comes from, a self-hating dirtbag. That's Stephen Schwartz. Now, moving on to a different sort of cult, we saw some interesting give and take here where, you know, I have used Weight Watchers myself.
Oh.
And Jonathan Larson has lost, you know, 45 pounds from Weight Watchers. Now, and I, you know, I have become a vegetarian as of late, a pescatarian, if you will, and I'm not going to go too much into that. I'm just deciding to do that because it's a little healthier. And I've been taking an inordinate amount of flack from Kayla the Costco ho at the board, Mark Riley, who has a double or nothing bet that I can't stay off the meat for another month. So he's been sort of like, you know, ribbing me a little bit, like, you know, ribbing my newly found bean fat, my ghee belly, right? So, and he's like, you know,
tofu tummy,
right? So I said to him, I said, you know, well, you know what? Don't you feel a little awkward about your size because you're not, you know, you're not svelte, I wouldn't say. And yesterday he made this whole case for like, oh no, right, Kylie, I'm Riley, no, right, Kalo, I'm complete. I just did a hybrid of Riley and Kalo. I just
Kylo.
Did Kylo. But yes, you're completely comfortable. Then all of a sudden on the break, I see you perusing the core system, the Weight Watchers core book that Jonathan Larson has come in and begun to convert you. See, he's got his own religious literature now, Larson, who is certainly not a religious man. But now all of a sudden it's like, this can change you. I saw, did you see the shining glow in his eyes? And then Kalo just sort of perks up. And then I saw the seeds of self-esteem lacking, a little self-doubt around the fat. But yesterday, Joey confidence about the fat Kalo was. Am I right?
Yes, I'm bipolar, much like you.
Okay. All right, I just want to make sure we understand what's going on. Hey, and if there's any way I can help you lose those extra pounds, you let me know. Is there something I can do? You know, if you need a little backup or something. You need me to do what my mother did all my life?
What is that?
Okay, here, I'll we're at a restaurant, okay? I'm my mother, and you're me. And the waitress is there, and order the slice of chocolate cake.
Yeah, can I have a slice of chocolate cake?
Oh, do you need that? Do you really need that? I mean, you can have it, but do you need it? How about a little of that? You want me to do that for you?
That sounds nice, but I think I can take care of myself.
There you go.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, all right, that's fine. I understand.
What was your name when you were a little kid? What'd your coach call you? Marshmallow Marin?
Yeah, Marshmallow Marin was one of the nicknames. Yeah. Look at Marshmallow go. Look at him run around the bases. Go, Marshmallow, go. That didn't have any effect on me, nor did my mother taking me into the department store and go, where are the Huskies? My kid's fat. Look at him. Even after I broke my nose and I ordered, she took me to Dairy Queen to make me feel better. I got a banana split. Hey, do you really need that, Mark? Do you really need it? Well, you just brought me here because of my nose. Like, but can't you just get a regular size sundae? Because, you know, you are representing me in the world, and I'm not fat. Look at me. Am I fat? No. My first, the first two words I learned were mommy skinny. That was the first two words I learned, and she taught them to me. I'm not saying I'm
screwed. Is she still listening to our show?
Are you kidding? She loves this stuff. All she heard right there was skinny. That's the entire conversation we heard. All my mother is really registering is, did he say it was sin? That's so nice.
There you go.
Yeah, she just loves it. You know, she, yeah, all right. You know, I don't want to be too narcissistic or self-indulgent.
But Maren, seriously, what would your mom think about you now?
Right now?
Yeah.
My mother tries to...
You are a disappointment to her.
Dude,
man, this isn't going to end. I can see this now.
Now, what did my mother say recently? I heard you were good. Or, no, I can't remember. My dad, though, who I'm going to see soon. Oh, yeah, that's right. My mom said that I heard you were pretty outstanding. Can we just go with outstanding? Can we just go with that? And this is also the same mom that said, I like listening because it's nice to know you're alive.
Wow.
That's it. And my dad said, who knows, maybe this radio thing could lead to something. Yeah, that's great. So, Riley, we're going to talk about the issues. Is that the idea? We're going to talk about drugs?
Yeah, we're going to talk about drugs. We're going to talk a little bit about steroids. We're going to talk about sports. We're going to talk about performance enhancement outside of sports.
Right.
The psychology of performance enhancement.
Well, this is an interesting thing that we started talking about yesterday that you brought up is that, you know, that a lot of this steroid use is actually fueled by the fans. And in other industries, when we talk, when we broaden the scope of what are performance-enhancing drugs, they're indulged, the people that use them, the products of whatever industry, whether it's athletics or music or whatever, are encouraged by the fans, by the industry, by everybody but the law.
Yeah. If you got to get something done, if something external will help you get it done, the message is, do it.
Right or wrong? Is it evolution? Is it just the next phase? Or should we realize our limitations and, you know, honor what we have? There's some interesting questions with this, and we're going to get into them, Mark and I are, after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Twenty past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley over there.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Right now, you know, when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I, as you know, I have this brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headliner translator, which is proven to be very effective. So let's feed it some headlines. From the New York Times, Bush and Putin to announce plan against nuclear terrorism. Eat that. Eat that, machine. Bush and Putin to announce plan against nuclear terrorism. Translation, phony diplomatic junket ends with phony diplomatic announcement. All right. Okay. Here we go. From Fox News, hunt for bin Laden still on. Hunt for bin Laden still on. Translation, convenient villain resting comfortably in CIA safe house. From the Associated Press, Thompson's ashes may be shot from cannon. Thompson's ashes may be shot from cannon. Translation, stream of consciousness writer enters airstream unconsciously.
Wow.
I have a call. Can we take that call? What is this, a surprise? Hello?
Good morning.
Oh, my mother. What's going on, Mom? How are you?
Mark, I just want to tell you.
Uh-oh.
I think you're wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm very proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
You look wonderful.
Oh, my God.
Are we on TV?
I know you don't have to make fun. This is the truth.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, I'm glad you said I was skinny.
Okay. Now, how about an apology for everything else?
I've done that already.
All right.
I'm waiting for forgiveness.
All right. You have forgiveness. What did you already go running and walk your dogs and go to a Pilates class?
I'm on my way.
Okay. I love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm on my way. To which one? All of them.
All of them.
All right, so let's get into this, Riley. You know, you were interested in this story because the sort of broadening of this issue of performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah, and it's kind of been manifested in the whole steroids thing.
Okay.
Steroids thing, long story short, Jose Canseco, used to be a star ball player, he's not in baseball anymore, mm-hmm. wrote a book that alleged that not only were a bunch of his teammates on the Oakland Athletics teams of the late 80s, early 90s steroid users, but that he shot a couple of them in the butt with needles in the clubhouse.
They're just having fun. You know, boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys, yeah. But one of those guys was Mark McGwire, the guy who ended up breaking the home run record.
Mm-hmm.
And at a point, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth about Canseco. Barry Bonds, of course, is an ongoing steroid story. Jason Giambi, who plays here in New York for the Yankees, admitted in front of a grand jury that he took steroids. Gary Sheffield, also from the Yankees, said he unknowingly took steroids. So it is a big issue in baseball, and part of the issue is how the fans are going to react and whether or not this constitutes cheating.
Right.
Now, when we talk about performance-enhancing drugs, and this is where I kind of took off of it, it really was not just about sports, not from where I sit, not from my vantage point, because I have heard about people talking about all manner of recreational drugs being performance-enhancing. If you read any books about jazz in the 1940s and 1950s, you will read stories about guys who believed that certain musicians were great because they got high.
But you know, it's weird. The interesting thing about that whole setup to the argument is that there's a difference between believing and actually having, you know, physical repercussions. You do steroids, you're going to turn into a mutant. You're going to have, you know, relatively superhuman capacities, you know, if you can do that sport. With heroin, if you shoot heroin or you snort heroin or you do whatever you're going to do with opiates, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that, you know, you're going to play good music, and it's not necessarily specifically performance enhancing. And then there's the whole argument of sort of like you need to really learn how to play before you do the heroin. You know, doing the heroin is not going to make you play better if you don't know how to play.
If you don't know how to play,
there was a myth to it.
No, there was obviously an element of mythology. But Mark, here's what I think a lot of people reacted to. They knew that there were certain guys who were extraordinary players. And when they met these extraordinary players or played with them or went on the road with them, they realized very quickly that they were also drug users.
Sure.
And they got to a point where they really felt, now, they were wrong. And they will admit, most of them now in their older age, that they were absolutely wrong about this. In fact, some of the same musicians that were getting high told them they were wrong at the time. But they still thought, if I get high, I'll play better because this guy gets high and he's the best.
And also, to a certain degree, the industry forgave them. They just wanted their performers to be comfortable and functioning at what they thought was their best musically. Or whatever they had to do to get by, to make the dough, to get on the road, to get in the studio, they would do and they would provide for. And I don't know if that's evident. I'm not a sports guy, so I don't know if there's a certain amount of, you know, looking the other way around this stuff.
There is a lot of looking the other way because sports is, at least bills itself as a meritocracy. You have to be able to hit the ball further, throw the ball further, hit somebody harder, depending on what sport we're talking about. And with the exception of basketball, for whatever reasons, there's never been a steroid scandal in basketball. But in baseball and football, two sports where there have been steroid allegations over time, it's always been about worrying that some other kid that's coming up behind you is going to be able to outdo you.
Yeah. Well, there's like performance enhancement. You know, it's such a broad idea. You know, even, you know, in the military and even truckers and, you know, there's so much, you know, Dexedrine was, you know, Benzedrine and Dexedrine were available almost over the counter in the 50s. So you had a whole generation of like Lenny Bruce was a Benzedrine head, you know, whether or not that fuel. I mean, I've done Dexedrine, you know, whether or not it fuels anything, the mythology around thinking it does. One thing, you know, practically is that, yeah, you take speed, you're going to stay up longer, you're going to keep your focus longer, if you're going to be on the road for 16 hours, 20 hours, you might need a little go fast, a little Benny, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, the military uses this stuff to keep these guys awake and alert, and they go up and down. They give them, you know, their Bennies, and they give them their downers if they got to fly long runs. You know, what is the slippery slope here in terms of, what do we expect? accept as a culture? I mean, are we going to get to a point where sports is going to be filled with mutants, filled with superhuman people? Do we have to create a special division of sports? Is this part of evolution, Riley?
Well, look, you can talk about, if you want to go talk about the origins of performance-enhancing drugs, there were all kinds of rumors that, for example, the Mayans and these other ancient civilizations chewed coca leaves as a way to build endurance, to build some of some of the artifacts that we worship today.
So is it okay? Is it not okay? Call us, 866-303-2270 if you've ever used steroids, or what do you think about them?
Do you care?
Yeah, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Go 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Yeah.
866-303-2270 is our phone number. We're talking about performance-enhancing drugs of all kinds. You know, what are the implications, right or wrong? Part of evolution, is it inevitable? Are we going to become mutants of all kinds? Do we risk our lives to become a more efficient machine? We'll take your calls in just a second. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now, on the phone, once again, is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's having a bean, and you're about to be safe.
All right, good.
Hallelujah.
All right. As you know, Hunter S. Thompson died this week.
Yes, Mark. I am sorry for your loss.
Well, that's very nice, Lawton. Did you hear what Stephen Schwartz of the Weekly Standard said about Hunter and his work? Quote, incoherent scribblings, quote-unquote, mainly noise, quote, incapable of inspiring younger readers, quote, Thompson left no authorial legacy. What an idiot. Thompson left clamor without content, he said.
Yeah. They went easy on it.
What are you talking
about? But that's to be expected under the circumstances. It's a tasteful, sensitive publication, the Weekly Standard.
Oh, my
God. Those folks understand grief.
Oh, come on. They don't understand. They understand squat. Hunter S. Thompson was one of the most influential writers of his generation. He was a hero of the counterculture, my friend, a hero.
I don't want to pile on at a time like this, Mark, but the counterculture is deader than a 10-point buck at Ted Nugent's house.
Well, how can you say that, Lawton?
Well, look at a calendar. Did Peter Max do the illustration?
Oh, come
Does
on.
It have a picture of the moon landing on it? The 60s are over, my friend, and you lost 72-0. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, for turning the hose on that whole smelly, immoral, socialist, ungrateful, blasphemous, unpatriotic, lazy, tasteless, vegetarian, smart aleck, cowardly generation.
Wow.
The smell of patchouli was choking the American
Eagle. Awful. You are in so much denial. You're just like Schwartz, man. You have no creativity yourself, so you try to tear down anyone who does. Self-hatred. No creativity.
You know, I love creativity, okay? You give me some reruns of Matlock and a bowl of Chex Mix, and I'm a happy man. But happened in the 60s, Mark? Come on. Did anything of lasting value come from that?
Come on. Bob Dylan, John Coltrane, the Beatles, Allen Ginsberg, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Didion, Jean-Luc Godard, Hunter S. Thompson, Warhol, Martin Luther King.
Mark, I never heard of any of these folks.
What do you guess you have? That's ridiculous. You have heard of them. You're lying to me. Yes, you have heard of them. You have.
Okay, I have. I just like to wind you up.
That's great. That's great.
But, okay, here's my real problem.
What?
Everything about the 60s was so self-indulgent.
Oh.
Dope and free love and poems that don't rhyme and facial hair, Mark.
Oh, come
that's not a legacy. Everything was all about me. Me, 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 me. Well, let me tell you something, Mark. There's no I in America.
Well, you know, actually, there is an I in America, Lawton, and there's also a me. And those people were visionaries, my friend, and tried to see the greater possibilities in our society. Your people are all about repression, conformity, control, frightened little cowards, stifling the progress of culture. Stop it! You guys always go on and on about freedom. Well, Hunter S. Thompson was actually living it, and you hated him for it. You hate the counterculture because you hate life, Lawton. You hate life. What's the matter? What? Oh, my God.
When I was a kid, I used to read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas on the covers with a flashlight every night.
Mm-hmm.
I named my goldfish Uncle Dick.
Yep.
I read Burroughs. Ginsburg, I let my freak flag fly, Mark.
See that?
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fit.
Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night.
Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness.
Of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Sideburns, Mark.
Oh,
now, whoever thought those looked good?
Come on.
That's them hygienic
vests
and wearing paisley.
I thought
that
was
a communist plot for sure.
Oh,
you
goodbye.
Guys
that's
lost
it.
72
goodbye.
To nothing.
Goodbye,
Lord. God loves you.
Goodbye.
Deal with it.
Okay. Well, I thought we were on the same team there for a second. Back to performance drugs, performance enhancing drugs. Matthew in Australia streaming. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, Matthew.
Hello.
What's up,
I
man?
I can't believe I'm actually on your show.
I'm happy you're here.
Yeah, well, I used to use a few years ago. I did start using again, but
steroids?
I quit for about 3 years. So I started when I was 17.
Yeah.
And I basically went till I was about 21.
So,
and just every now, I wouldn't do them continuously, but like I'd do 6 week cycles and I'd come off for about 6 weeks. And
so you have no problem with it?
No. Well, it's a bit, it's all a bit of a myth, all the side effects, but there are side effects, believe me, there are.
Yeah, we've heard.
Like what?
Yeah. Well, basically, your liver count goes up a bit, but it comes back down again, so. I don't see what the problem with that is, unless you use a lot of it, but I never really did because I couldn't afford that much.
Matthew, what did you use it for? What was your purpose?
Bodybuilding.
Bodybuilding?
Because, you know, like, I guess when I was that age, I was a bit insecure about my appearance, and I, you know, would use them, and now I'm not insecure, but I did start using them again, but, you know, that's just for, I guess, because... I just want to have some fun.
What, just for the heck of it?
Because you like being big.
Hey, wait a minute, Matthew.
Well, I'm not that big.
But wait, I got to ask you this, Matthew. I mean, there are guys who were using steroids, who were weightlifters and were bulked up, and some of them ended up dying weighing like 50 pounds. Are you at all afraid of that?
Oh, yeah, well, I know of some guys who really hurt themselves, but, I mean, they're nut jobs, that's why. I mean, if you have any idea how much stuff they'd use...
Yeah, right, they're not hooked. I mean, if they're hooked, I'm not hooked. I can quit any time, right?
I know what you mean. I know it's a hooked thing, though, but it's not the same sort of thing, though.
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not a drug that gives you a rush or anything. It's really quite a disgusting feeling when you inject the stuff, and once you come off, it's like, after a few weeks, like about 8 weeks I've been on right now... I'm pretty sick of using them, so I'm basically going to stop now. And when the feeling goes away, hopefully I'll wait for about another 8 weeks. So I might use it again. I might not, because you know it's quite expensive now since the Olympics.
All right, well,
since the Olympics.
Be careful, man. Matthew, thanks for calling.
Thanks.
You know,
since the Olympics.
But that was sort of like this, like it jacked up the price. Like, well, yeah. Okay.
What he's implying is that all of these Olympic athletes are steroid users.
The interesting thing was is like, one, he says you know, he's not insecure anymore. Yeah, his self-esteem is healthy. Two, he's not hooked yet. He's sitting there. It's like it's disgusting when you inject it, and like it just you don't get a rush out of it. I've been doing it for 8 weeks.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not about that rush. It's about the rush he gets from bolstering his self-esteem by getting big through injecting drugs that enable him to get ripped. And so but to classify it as something like it's just part of my hobby. It's a little crazy, isn't it, Megan? Listening in New York on Sirius. How are you?
Hey, Megan.
Good. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
I have if it was TV, I probably wouldn't tell you my opinion on it because I know I'm very much in the. Not many people agree with me, but as far as professional athletes, not necessarily personal use like your last caller, I think that, like, with medical supervision, I don't understand what the difference is between taking a Percocet and playing on the field with an injured ankle or, drinking a cup of coffee versus getting bulked up and, bigger during training. And I think that it's like the sports equipment of the future, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thanks for your call. You know, what she's saying, the difference is that there, if you drink coffee or you take a Percocet, that's you're trying to, you know, you're compensating for a physical problem because you're injured. You probably shouldn't be playing. But it seems to me that steroids, Mark, if I'm wrong, literally almost change you genetically. They mutate you into something what of a super, you know, human capacity. It changes the playing field. It changes the rules. You know, it's not just about you know, overlooking injuries or a temporary juice up.
Well, it's not, and see what happens, particularly in baseball, where you have guys like Barry Bonds who came into the league weighing 180 pounds and now is up to 230 and looks very different. And particularly when you have guys who two seasons ago were all bulked up, and then they come into camp weighing 20 pounds less than they did at the end of last year, there is a lot of suspicion that's going on that people are using.
I just don't know how this can fragment the industry. I don't know. It seems to me that it may be inevitable that we move towards this, that we move towards more machine-like dispositions, that we, you know, we start making acceptance for bionic, if you will, that, you know, perhaps that, you know, sports fragments. You already have extreme sports that are now integrating themselves into the regular sport pantheon. Maybe there will be sort of like, you know, very special Olympics for actual mutants that have done so much that literally people go to see, like, oh my God, that guy's arms are as big as trees, and that, you know, the liabilities are when the pitcher pitches, if it hits a guy in the head, it might literally take his head off or implant itself in the guy's side. That will be what sports, what real edge sports will come to look like.
Look, I remember Lyle Alzado, who was an outstanding defensive end for, at first, the Denver Broncos, later my team, the Raiders. And Lyle Alzado was a big, he weighed 275 pounds, man. And before very long, after he got sick, and he admitted that he got sick because he shot up too many steroids, the man died weighing something less than 140 pounds.
Yeah, and don't miss, you got to understand, even that guy on the phone says your liver count goes up a little bit. There were some steroids that caused acromegaly that distorted your features, you know, permanently. You know, that these are people that are willing to take this risk to, you know, to enhance their performance. I think it's...
Because there's money in enhanced performance.
I understand. And even now, musicians take beta blockers to eliminate their nervous energy or their fear. And they've done tests that the music that these chamber musicians...
Fear?
Yes.
Where?
Mark, it's all for fear.
Oh, you know, I'm sorry.
How long it lasts, that's the big question.
I'm scared of heights. Can something help me?
Absolutely. Well, these tests actually have proven that, you know, these people on beta blockers are able to perform better music, that they are able to honor the score in a way that is more pristine, more focused, and more expressive than those who weren't on them. They did this with placebos. It's a frightening thing. Is this where humans need to be? Are we at a point in time as a species that we no longer have to accept our limitations, that we might as well just push it and mutate to the point where who the hell knows what will happen?
Yeah, I'll have a beta blocker and a Diet Coke because I need to lose weight.
Bend over, hear your muscles for the day.
Yeah.
I'm gonna give you a shot of the juice. We'll be back. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
There we go, 51 past the hour, going to land this thing. 3 days. Did I tell you what you're listening to? It's Morning Sedition. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
I'm Mark Maron. Sarah America Radio is the network. Clutch Larson in the booth with Kent the Colonel Jones. P.W. McDonald on the phones. Kalo the Costco Ho, who is, you know, it's good that you're going to lose that weight. Terrific. Dan Pashman's going to lose. And Linda Pashman is in the other room. Comes in the middle of our discussion about weight and goes, when did this become The View? All right, anyways. It's 3 days before the Academy Awards around this time each year. Every lazy media outlet relies on some self-appointed expert to talk about all the nominated movies. Well, Morning Sedition has decided to do the same thing. So we're using the one guy who's seen more movies than any of us. Here now is the phone conversation about the Oscars I had with Morning Sedition's resident movie reviewer, my father, in a segment we like to call Dr. Maron's Movies.
Hello.
Hey, Dad, what are you doing? You sleeping?
Yeah, I was hanging out in bed.
Come on. Come on. It's time to get up. You want to talk about movies?
We've only seen a couple.
But what about the Oscars? Have you seen all the Oscar movies?
We saw Million Dollar Baby and I saw Sideways for the second time.
Yeah, did you like it the second time?
Yeah.
What'd you think of that? You think that deserves, like, the best writing?
That's a hard call, you know. I don't know what their criteria, what they're looking for. You never do, but, you know, it's a politics, it's a whatever, but that Giacinto, I guess is his name.
Paul Giamatti?
Paul Giamatti, yeah.
Yeah.
He sort of helped the picture. He was a great sort of constant and straight man, and the picture was good.
We're pretty selfish guys ourselves. It's something we could identify with, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Hotel Rwanda and The Woodsman were also good.
Oh, you saw Hotel Rwanda?
Yeah, it was excellent.
You think Cheadle deserves the best actor?
Well, I think he comes close. You know, I mean, I think he's American. He portrayed the Rwandan national perfect as far as accent goes.
And the other people that are up are Clint Eastwood and Jamie Foxx, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Johnny Depp. Do you think Cheadle's got it over those other guys?
You got a lot of emotional background in the Eastwood saga from day one. You know, he's just sort of been there and done so much. So
yeah, yeah.
And you can't deny personal input from the judges as to who they're going to take.
Did you see Kinsey?
Saw Kinsey.
She's up for the best supporting.
No, be a surprise to me if she gets that.
How about Sophie Okonedo in Hotel Rwanda? Was she good?
Yeah, she was good.
Maybe she
was. Yeah. That's a heavy picture. You got to see that picture.
I've been wanting to see it. I haven't gotten to see it yet. I know it looks pretty heavy. I read about the Rwandan genocide, and it was just reading about it was devastating.
Yeah, but it's just this really gets you right in there, almost like Schindler's List, only with more action. It's a real shoot 'em up happening in Rwanda. You know, it's very, very, very disappointing that those things are still going on. It's just cuckoo.
All right, so I'm going to see you in a few weeks.
Yeah, I'll be there. We got a whole bunch of green chili, but I don't know how it's going to stay frozen. We got little packets that Rosie wants to bring you.
Don't go crazy.
Yeah, I know.
All right, Dad, I love you. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for calling. I love you. Bye.
Okay, bye. So let's sum it up here. The deal on some of this year's Oscar nominees. Sideways is good. Paul Giacinto sort of held the picture together. There's a lot of emotion in the saga of Clint Eastwood, and that might sway some of the voters. Don Cheadle comes close to winning Best Actor because he's American and he portrays a Rwandan national really well. And Hotel Rwanda has more action than Schindler's List. It's a real shoot 'em up. He's so funny, he doesn't even know it. Now, who's on the phone now? Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Who's that?
This is your brother.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
Who is this?
This is Craig.
Oh, what are you doing?
I don't know. I just sit in awe at the courage you have of putting our parents on live radio.
Believe me, some people would call it something different. You heard Mom, too?
I heard them both, and I'm just saying, I barely have the courage to talk to them live one-on-one, but I have them on the radio.
How you feeling? You feel fat?
That's one of the reasons I'm talking to you is because I'm actually not proud, but I've juiced. I've done steroids.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Craig, there's so many things that I don't know about you that you never share with me. How come that's something you're supposed to notice if you do them.
It was part of the ride along our family's desperate obsession to lose weight.
Okay. Oh, man. So
I was told that you burn fat faster, can convert your fat to muscle faster.
Yeah.
I went to the mad doctor, and not our dad, but just another mad doctor. and got the prescription for pills and some shots and.
Oh my God.
In trying for, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this stuff on radio, but I got a life too, but I guess it's all right. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, sure. That means it didn't really happen.
Well,
right. So you okay now? You're doing yoga now, though, right?
It was all behind me, but it was funny because I would go into this weird little office, and I'd be coming out.
I got it, yeah. I got to go, Craig. We're running out of time here. I got to call you later. We'll talk about it. Thank you for telling me on the air in front of everybody.
See you later, bro.
Okay, see you later, man.
That's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. You tell a story. All right. With Sage the symbolic non-burning of the Pope's new book. 2, 4 days until the Oscars. Ladies, make sure all that rain hasn't caused your Vera Wang gown to mildew. 3, make sure the upcoming bird flu epidemic is free range. 4, download stolen numbers from Paris Hilton's cell phone book that were posted on the internet and make some fundraising calls for MoveOn.org. 5, today's phrase, drop it into conversation. Bush in Germany, man. That's like the chicken coming home to roost. You know what I'm saying. Wake up and smell the jackboot, sheeple.
Tomorrow we're a best of in the morning and Randy in the afternoon.
My brother was juicing. What is that?
Hey, have a good one, Marin.
You too, Riley.